Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in tonight. We have some very interesting sound for you today from CNN yesterday. Seymour Hersh, former investigative reporter for the New York Times and now probably one of the premier investigative journalists for the New Yorker magazine, being interviewed by Republican Candy Crowley. I think you'll find what Seymour Hersh had to say interesting, threatening, scary. We have an email first, and it's from Dave in Brooklyn, New York. And Dave writes about, the testimony by David Addington and John Yoo last week that we covered fairly extensively with some of the sound from that hearing. The arrogance and disdain for the Constitution these two punks displayed in front of a congressional committee was pretty stunning. But I've received a number of emails about that particular appearance by these two criminals, and Dave in Brooklyn's email pretty much sums it up. He writes, Mike, Addington's and Yoo's arrogance and disdain for the Constitution and Congress, as evidenced by their behavior during their hearing last Friday, was indeed breathtaking, but hardly surprising. They had nothing to lose, since Democrat Jerry Nadler and Democrat John Conyers fully support Democrat Nancy Pelosi in taking impeachment off the table. It was all a sham. The Democrats could look very righteous and outraged, but everyone knew the House Judiciary Committee could do nothing else to Addington and Yoo other than to take an afternoon of their time. By giving the House Judiciary Committee the finger, Addington and Yoo gave a master class to the next generation of fascists that, we assume, will move into the White House in January. This is how, they seem to say, a real executive branch deals with those maggots in the legislative branch, the so-called People's House. Don't think for one second that those two in Unity, New Hampshire, weren't taking notes. Dave. Also, I guess this is breaking news. It's out on the internet, but I haven't seen it on any news reports, any break-ins. A naval interceptor rocket apparently accidentally targeted, this is part of SDI, Star Wars, the naval interceptor rocket accidentally targeted and blew up the returning Jesus Christ today. This is during an afternoon test over the Pacific. And apparently some kind of retaliatory offensive has been set off by the hosts of heaven. An Air Force General, Jason somebody, who's head of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Shield Program, declined comment at first, then said, God, what a mess. He said, on our screens, Jesus looked suspiciously like a Chinese MIRV-9 nuclear missile, which is frankly an easy mistake to make. The real surprise is that we hit something, he said. Now, following the explosion, burning radioactive pieces of Jesus rained down over a wide area of the western seaboard, it says here, causing spot fires and random miracles. Well, that explains the 1,400 fires in California. NASA has asked that the debris not be touched or collected as souvenirs. While General Jason described the situation as unfortunate, he remained optimistic. He said, quote, we do apologize for the collateral and spiritual damage this has caused, but we would like to point out that in the war on terror, you can't take risks. And hey, this proves it finally works. Quickly here, a spokesperson for the World Council of Churches, the Most Right Reverend Dr. So-and-so-and-so-and-so, said that, quote, quite frankly, we're relieved. We just weren't ready for such a literal fulfillment of prophecy. But in this difficult time, we do encourage people of faith to consider the rich beauty of other gods and sources of spiritual inspiration, such as Allah, Buddha, or George Clooney. The National Association of Evangelicals is meeting to decide whether we are now technically in the thousand years and why no one ever spotted that the great dragon from Revelation was in fact a Trident ICBM in the original Greek. And then there's this. Roads and chimneys throughout the nation, especially on the West Coast, remain clogged by thousands of born-again, pre-tribulation evangelicals after believers were only partially caught up into the clouds and then plummeted back to earth at Mach 5. FEMA has set up a national crisis hotline, 1-800-RAPTURE-RUPTURE. And meanwhile, Tyndall House Publishers announced a new Left Behind series, a 23-volume sequel, taking into account today's events. They expect it to be on the shelves Friday. Now, there were some believers, mostly in the Third World, who refused to accept the early reports of the second death of Christ, especially after he was spotted on a tortilla in Mexico. You can get the full story to this at wittenbergdoor.com, W-I-T-T-E-N, Berg, like B-U-R-G, wittenbergdoor.com, wittenbergdoor.com. I haven't heard anything about this, so I don't know if it's true or not. Iraq is demanding an explanation from the U.S. military about the death of a relative of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Authorities Sunday said the relative was shot dead Friday in a raid by U.S. soldiers in Hindia, east of the holy city of Karbala. Local leaders said the raid violated an agreement that transferred responsibility for Karbala's security from U.S. to Iraqi forces last year. The U.S. is investigating the incident. That was payback. Or that may have been it was payback when U.S. military, acting on orders from corporate America, when corporate America found out that this morning the Iraqi oil ministry did not give closed bids to the five U.S., British, and one French oil company to have no-bid contracts to extract and own Iraq's oil and pay Iraq a royalty. Quite a surprise, and I wrote about it in my mini-blog today at novamradio.com. It was quite a surprise when the Iraqi oil minister, who will soon die of a heart attack or in a car wreck, the Iraqi oil minister decided that there were going to be no-bid contracts, that it's out there on the free market for any company who wants to bid. We'll watch and report. As a result of all this, crude oil rose to a record today, above $143 a barrel. And part of that is based on the speculation of the trouble with Iran may disrupt supply from that country. Pressure on Iran to end its uranium enrichment program, as you know, and the falling value of the U.S. dollar may drive prices to $170 a barrel. That's according to the president of OPEC, Shakib Khalil. Foreign ministers from the Group of Eight Nations last week suggested more talks to coax Iran into opening its nuclear program to inspectors. Well, they already have. After speculation that Iran faces an imminent Israeli strike, John Bolton, former U.S. envoy to the United Nations and a member of the Bush crime family, has speculated that Israel will strike Iran between the U.S. presidential election in November and the inauguration of the new president in January. Okay, a little roundup of the news. When we come back, Cy Hirsch, interviewed by CNN's Candy Crowley. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Forgive the killing, the war you have planned. Jesus washed the blood stains from your
You know, it'll take time to restore chaos and order, but we will.
21 past the hour. Yesterday, Seymour Hersh, Cy Hersh, was interviewed by Candy Crowley on CNN about his most recent article in the New Yorker, an expose of the of further criminal acts by the Bush administration, facilitated and enabled by Democrats in positions of leadership in the U.S. House and Senate. This has got to stop. And you know, that statement is pure rhetoric because it's not going to stop. There is no doubt. I have zero doubt now that as to whether or not the Bush crime family is going to launch an attack against Iran. Any reservations I had are pretty much gone. And the resulting chaos that we're going to have to deal with is almost impossible to think about. And I'm not sure exactly what tack to follow, just for me personally. I'm sure you're maybe confronted with the same situation. How are you to think about this? How are you to react to this building attack on Iran? How are you to react when it does occur? How are we, you, I, anyone, to react when the Iranians retaliate and Israel retaliates and Pakistan retaliates and India retaliates, and Russia retaliates, and China retaliates, and the European Union will do something. Bush and his crime family seem hell-bent on ending it all. That's not alarmist talk. The possibilities of absolute ultimate destruction as a result of our attack on Iran is just crystal clear. This is not idle speculation. This is it's not a game. It's not a thought problem. It's not a you know, some sort of event that really has no basis in reality. It is grounded in reality, the reality of the Bush crime family. Hersh talks about his article in the current issue of the New Yorker, and you can get it online, Preparing the Battlefield, about the escalation of the secret, private war in Iran.
This president did escalate the covert war, the secret war inside Iran. We've been doing stuff inside Iran since 05, pretty much, pretty heavily. You know, looking at the nuclear facilities, collecting intelligence, trying to undermine the regime, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a significant escalation this year. First of all, he got a great deal of authorization to spend up to $400 million. That doesn't mean he spent it all yet, but he's got that kind of authorization from one of the secret committees. If anybody saw Charlie Wilson's war, you know, Charlie Wilson was able to generate a lot of money secretly. That's what happens in Congress. And the other major thing is that we've sent in a special task force that operates out of Afghanistan into Iran. I did notice what Ambassador Crocker said about not cross-border, and I have a lot of respect for him, and I don't want to challenge him, but the fact is we're inside. We're not necessarily cross-border. We have teams inside Iran, and these include a Joint Special Operation Force, the most elite commando unit, and basically they're guys that go after high-value targets around the world. You know, they capture them or kill them, so it's a significant increase in American potential for damage inside Iran.
Now think about that for a second. Supposing the Russians had special ops teams inside the United States. For sure, the Iranians know that these teams are operating. Supposing we had Chinese special ops teams inside the United States working either in tandem with the Russians or in opposition to the Russians, but let's supposing they were looking at our nuclear facilities and collecting intelligence, trying to undermine the George W. Bush regime. Supposing this force operated out of Mexico into the United States, what do you think would be the reaction of the United States? What do you think would happen? Well, first and foremost, if we captured alive any of these special ops teams, their deaths would go down in the annals of torture as some of the most exquisite and monumentally painful since the Inquisition. That's number one. But that would all be done in private. Number two would be a massive attack, a massive preemptive attack, civilian populations be damned, against Russia and China, or either, or both. This is what would happen in the United States if special teams of commandos were undermining, to an even greater degree than George Bush has done, the rule of law in this country, spreading fear, taking out high-value targets, so-called. Those are human beings. And yet, the Bush crime family and the Democrats in Congress do this with impunity. We'll have some more for you when we come back. Stay with us.
You're listening to Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
Candy Crowley on CNN interviewed Cy Hirsch on Sunday talk program. He has an article out in The New Yorker entitled Preparing the Battlefield, wherein Cy explains how we are already at war in Iran and have been for about the past 18 months, maybe a little bit longer. And the consequences of that action. Once the special ops teams are committed, so I understand, it's simply a matter of time before the invasion or the attack begins. The whole reason for the special ops teams is to electronically paint the targets and to let the attacking give the attacking missiles the proper coordinates where to drop their low-yield nuclear warheads. So that is occurring now. Crowley asks Cy Hirsch about what was the goal of these secret special forces missions into Iran. She says, so what's the end game here? What are they trying to accomplish? Is it to end the war in Iraq? Is it to overturn the government in Iran? Is it greasing the skids for a preemptive strike? What are our forces doing there?
I do have some access into some of the thinking, particularly in the vice president's office. They do not want, Bush and Cheney do not want to leave Iran in place with a nuclear program, but they believe a nuclear weapons program. They simply don't believe the national intelligence estimate that came up late last year that said they haven't done anything in military weapons, nuclear weapons since 03. They just don't believe it. So they believe that their mission is to make sure that before they get out of office next year, either Iran is attacked or it stops its weapons program. I do believe that. I think this is another example of putting an awful lot of pressure on the Iranian government. There's been a dramatic increase in kinetic events and chaos inside Iran. Almost every other day, there's another story in the Iranian press. I write about this in the article, too, about things blowing up, et cetera, et cetera. It looks like things are falling apart a little bit, and the central government certainly has more trouble. And I think the goal of this operation, this incredible operation with all this money, and by the way, it's the Democrats in Congress who basically looked the other way and said, take the money and run. They did not stop this money, the leadership that I'm talking about, the Democratic leadership. So basically, my guess is that I don't think we can safely say that any military action is off the table, no matter what happens. I wish I'm going to be wrong about all that. But this is really sort of an amazing development.
The Democratic leadership. And by the way, Seymour Hersh says it's the Democrats in Congress who basically looked the other way and said, here, take $500 million. Hersh just said they did not stop the money, the leadership I'm talking about, the Democratic leadership. This is stomach turning. And I still get emails criticizing me for saying that Barack Obama is turning out after the primary season with the beautiful rhetoric and the appealing campaign, the attractive candidate. He's turning out to be Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton was nothing more than a moderate Republican, if that moderate. And I'm getting emails, all kinds of emails from people condemning me for saying that. Don't do that, Mike. Remember the Supreme Court. Are you people out of your minds? Seriously, you Democrats. Are you as crazy as me? As I am? Because I'm still holding out hope. Come on. Come on. Candy Crowley then asks Cy Hersh why the Democratic leaders in Congress let such a dangerous operation take place without proper oversight. She says, this is from your article. Quote, the oversight process has not kept pace. It's been co-opted by the administration. The person familiar with the contents of the findings said, the process is broken, and this is dangerous stuff we're authorizing. End quote. Tell me first, Cy Hersh, what your sources say is so dangerous about this.
The president has to give a finding on covert action, any action that's covert. In other words, when CIA goes in someplace, if they get caught, there could be spies. So he has to tell the Congress about it. And the military simply is, the president, since 9/11, has decided that anything we do militarily, we don't have to tell anybody in Congress about. That's all preparing the battlefield. That's the title of the piece. And so what Congress gets told is something about CIA operations, and that's why they had a finding, but nothing about what the military is doing on the ground inside Iran. And so the people in the Senate, the House, particularly the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, Charlie Wilson's old subcommittee, we're talking about Congressman Obie, Congressman Murtha, some of the others, are really concerned because they're approving programs about which they don't have the whole story, and they know it, and they don't know what to do about it, and it's a source of enormous tension. The problem is it's also secret. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody can talk about it. It's a world that the White House controls because it's very top secret. A presidential finding that I'm writing about is a document you don't discuss on CNN. If you're the ambassador, you don't talk about it. I understand Senator McConnell was here, and the senators are able to say, those who know can say, I can't talk about it. So we in the public don't get much of a look.
It's top secret. It's a world the White House controls, not the Congress. The Congress that controls the purse strings and issues declarations of war. No. Mm-mm. It's the White House. And if Mr. Hersh is concerned about why people like Congressman Obie and Congressman Murtha are approving programs about which they don't have the whole story, and they know they don't have the whole story, what does that sound like to you? It sounds like, oh, I don't know, I hate to bandy about the word treason, but if you are approving covert actions, if you are spending taxpayers' money to kill people and destroy things in yet another country that has done nothing to us, and you are authorizing that as a member of a House committee, I don't know, maybe it's not treason. What would you call that? Is there a name for that? No, other than that, sir. Is there a name for that? This is what the Democratic Party leadership, from the top of the pile of dung all the way down to the committee chairmanships, this is what they're doing. This is what they're doing. While you and I sit on this radio program every night and scream about the lousy Republicans aren't doing anything. They're just being Republicans. Sneaky, snarky, cowardly little shadows darting hither and yon, pocketing their money, voting against stuff that would benefit the American people. That's what Republicans do. But the Democrats who make loud noises about withdrawal timetables and this and that and the other thing, are goddamn liars. Do you not get this? And I get these emails, Mike, you shouldn't talk bad about Democrats. You shouldn't talk bad about Barack Obama. Now, you've been doing this, Mike, and you got to stop. Why? Why do I have to stop? Because if you don't stop, you might influence enough people with your program, and John McCain will be president. Let me tell you something. At this point, where it concerns our foreign policy, it doesn't matter. Don't you get that? Barack Obama, John McCain, Hillary Clinton, all of them have declared unequivocally all options regarding Iran are on the table. It doesn't matter. Oh, but Mike. You yourself, Mike, used the other night the example of Earl Warren. Everybody thought he was a California right-winger. Governor of California, right-winger. Eisenhower appointed him. Look what he did. Liberal stuff. True Seeker, that was how many years ago? 60? So, where do you want to go with this? I mean, take a look at what Barack Obama has said in the past 2 weeks. He supports FISA, this criminal act, the destruction of the Fourth Amendment. He supports capital punishment. He has no problem with gun laws and gun ownership, thinks the states should have the right to decide that. The states. Even though it is in there is a controversial Second Amendment. Barack Obama declares, well, it should be up the states, you know. Excuse me, I gotta go. There's something really, really ugly occurring. In the meantime, with all the war talk, the price of oil is going off the chart, which doesn't mean this pissy ass $4.25 a gallon at the gas pump. That's only the most visible aspect for most of us. The increase, the horrendous increase in oil, demand is down, and the price keeps going up, which should give you a clue as to what's going on. But it is affecting every single aspect of the lives of every single person on earth, including, most critically, the production and acquisition of food.
Locations to suspend the Constitution and sustain the corporation. Their minutes, notes, and memos can't be shared. And by the way, does anybody know the current whereabouts of Kenneth Lee? Oh, it's national security of the public scrutiny. Policy of legal coup d'etat. Oh, we have a shadow government. Imagine that.
The next best thing to an impeachment hearing, it's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
Ten before the hour. So what are the Iranians doing in order to deal with the incursions into their country and the destruction and target painting and so on and so forth that is going on by U.S. Special Ops, the kidnappings, the murders, so on and so forth. How are the Iranians reacting? The United States would react with screaming denunciations of whoever was doing it, Russia, China, Cuba, you know, whoever, screaming denunciations. And if it were safe enough to attack, we would attack. In rethinking what I said about we would launch nukes against China and Russia if we found they were doing that in our country, I wasn't thinking when I said that. The United States never attacks a country that will destroy it, not since 1941. We always launch attacks against countries that cannot defend itself. And then after we have murdered hundreds of thousands or millions of its citizens, then we leave and the insurgent forces declare a victory. But we wind up doing what the leaders of this country wanted done. We slaughter hundreds of thousands of people, destabilize or overthrow governments, and then we leave. But we never pick on countries that have the capability of retaliating to a degree equal to our initial attack. Never. Ever. And that speaks volumes about us, doesn't it? So what is Iran ready to do? Or what is that country doing? According to the French news agency, Iran is in the process of digging 320,000 graves in border districts to allow for the burial of enemy soldiers in the event of any attack on its territory, according to a top Iranian commander, General Mir Faisal Baghrizadeh, said, quote, "In implementation of the Geneva Conventions, the necessary measures are being taken to provide for the burial of enemy soldiers. We have plans to dig 15 to 20,000 graves in each of the border provinces, or a total of 320,000. He said some of the graves will be mass graves if necessary. Baghrizadeh said Iran was keen to, quote, reduce the suffering of the families of the fallen in any attack against our country and prevent any repetition of the long and bitter experience of the Vietnam War, end quote. And according to Agence France-Presse, his comments came as the United States continued to refuse to rule out an eventual resort to force against Iran over its nuclear program. The comments also came as Israeli officials spoke of their determination to prevent Iran developing a nuclear capability at all costs. A former head of Israel's Mossad Foreign Intelligence Agency said in comments published yesterday that the Jewish state had 1 year to destroy Iran's nuclear program or face the risk of coming under nuclear attack. Shabtai Shavit told a London Weekly that, quote, the worst-case scenario was that Tehran would have a nuclear weapon within somewhere around a year. He told the Sunday Telegraph, quote, the time that is left to be ready is getting shorter all the time, end quote. So, now, of course, a lot of that is just bravado, isn't it? We are digging mini graves for the invader. But anyone who thinks Iran, a highly industrialized country, a population of 70,000 with a massive, well-trained armed force on three different levels, three different levels of armed forces, not unlike, but completely unlike, but still different from our Army, Navy, and Air Force. Plus the fact that a population of 70 million, plus an underground nuclear operation, whether it's peaceful or for the sake of producing nuclear weapons, is really immaterial at this point. That is not the issue. If the United States was concerned about a rogue Muslim nation having nuclear weapons, we would begin launching a strike 2 years ago against Pakistan. So that's not the issue. The issue is A, oil, B, the protection of Israel. Period. And under the subheads under oil is greed, power, corporate insanity, and what a nation does us, what a nation does when it is under the complete, and it is now, isn't it, control of corporate America. You doubt that? In this newest authorization for another $162 billion, I noticed that there were a few bucks tossed in to keep the veterans quiet. Shh, come on, we'll give you a little bit. We'll give you a little bit. Here, this will keep you quiet. $2.7 billion in aid for the Midwest floods. A few bucks for expanding the GI Bill, anti-drug enforcement in Latin America. Oh, yeah, that's a serious issue, isn't it? So here we are. Here we are. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. Email from Bob writes, Mike, the Bush regime figured out that they could get away with anything because nobody tried to stop them in any substantive way. The reasons why there has been no real opposition are irrelevant now. A compliant legislative branch, for whatever reason, is still a compliant legislative branch. The populace did nothing when the Constitution was shredded before our very eyes. I hear more bitching about gas prices now than I did when the Bush regime took away habeas corpus. The vaporization of the Fourth Amendment with the FISA compromise, so-called, is not a topic discussed. Talking with folks about current events is like swimming in oatmeal. I was talking to a guy about the Cy Hirsch piece in the New Yorker, and the topic immediately got changed to where am I going to sign up our son for swimming lessons? Is it denial, apathy, or ignorance? Does it matter? That's the kind of conversation we can idle away the evening with after we've dragged enough wood into the cave to keep warm during a nuclear winter. No happy bunny thoughts here, Bob. You know, also what I realized today, I mean, I've known this for a long time, but the thought occurred to me today that the news programs, the cable news shows, the half-hour-long, the hour-long shows are really nothing but gossip programs. Have you noticed that? Especially where it concerns, allegedly where it has political content. It's what did this candidate say about that candidate? What did this candidate surrogate say about that candidate surrogate? It's like a bunch of preteens gathered on the playground during lunch period, or old people sitting around in the retirement community, not feeling like going out and swimming or playing shuffleboard, so they talk about what this person's doing and that person's doing, who died, who's getting laid, who's this, who's that. That's what these news, so-called news shows are about. Have you noticed that? It's all political gossip. That's all it is. Political gossip. In other words, it's totally useless. And yet people adhere to these programs as if something is coming from them that is substantive or has value or is necessary to our decision-making process, what we're supposed to be doing right now, you know, you and me, the American public. We really have gone silent. We have flatlined, absolutely flatlined. And I don't get this. I don't get this. We have flatlined. There is no sign. There are no signs of life coming from the citizens of this country. Nothing. Can you tell me any? I was listening to our online news here during the break. Chrysler is getting out of the minivan business, closing down their main assembly plant in St. Louis, I believe. Just that's it. You know, gone. The ripple effect from $140, $150, $160, $170 a barrel oil is, I can't think of a word. Awesome. How's that word? I also read today, or I heard today, I think on Bloomberg News, that because of this all of a sudden food shortage, where the hell did that come from? But because maybe there's a slight upside to the food situation, believe it or not, more and more countries are refusing to export their food products. They're keeping them inside their own countries. Jesus Christ, it's about time. You know, the next time I go to this big farmer's market over here in DeKalb County and see that I have a choice of buying tomatoes from Mexico or tomatoes from Brazil or tomatoes from, Poland. You know, I feel like sometimes I'm just going to overturn the rows and rows and rows and rows of bright, shiny, poisonous tomatoes and scream, are there no goddamn tomatoes grown in Georgia? So maybe there's an upside to the food shortage anyway. That's right, world. We're all going to starve. Hold on to your food. Hold your food. Don't send it here, and we won't send it there. Maybe some natural force of nature will put an end to NAFTA. Will somebody soon start to realize that building crap at American factories in China and then spending the amount of money necessary to provide the fuel to bring the crap here and sell the crap in Walmart and all the other crap stores that Americans are so willing to go buy from, that maybe it would make more sense now, even given the fact that the American laborer is paid on average this enormous wage of about $12 or $13 an hour. Huh? Maybe bring the crap factories home. Let's make the crap here. Then the crap doesn't have to travel so far. So maybe there's an upside. Then we can all stay home and build our own crap and buy it and ruin it and buy it again, right? Kathy and I took Molly to see a movie on Sunday. Or Saturday. And I strongly recommend that you go see it. It's from Pixar. The Disney computer animation factory. And it's the most amazing animated film I've ever seen. It's Wall-E. Wall-E. You've got to see it. You've got to see it. Now, Molly kind of lost interest at various points, and that we get her back. But Kathy and I sat there just riveted. You've got to see Wall E. And what does that have to do with what I just said? If you go see the flick, you'll understand. You'll understand. The primary directive of the Bush crime family was to drive the price of oil up to such a level that never, ever, 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 ever again would it reach the level it reached during the golden years of Bill Clinton, when I believe it was down to about $10 a barrel. That was the prime directive that came directly from Dick Cheney and corporate, his corporate masters, the oil companies, who said, do this, do this. This is your goal. We will see that you have 8 years, but do it. To prevent the price of oil from going any direction but up. And the way you do that is, first of all, make sure the American dollar is devalued to the point where it's almost like money in Zimbabwe. Okay, not quite. And secondly, you interrupt the flow of oil into the international market to such a degree that it jacks up the prices of the available sloppy black crap. How do you do that? Well, invade Iraq, threaten Iran, foment all sorts of disasters in the African oil-producing states like Nigeria. In other words, just get out there in the international market with your special ops teams and wreak havoc. And then the speculators will do the rest of the work for you. Because the speculators belong to that little elite 0.01%. The hedge fund operators, the speculators, the people who are driving not just this economy, but the global economy into the ground. There's an awful lot. Gee, I think Naomi Klein wrote a book about that. Disaster capitalism. Wow. Somebody's already come out with it. But Naomi Klein's book was not supposed to be a how-to manual for the Bush crime family. It was supposed to be an overview of what these rat bastards have done to us. But I wonder when we flatlined and why. I really do. I know that sometimes people feel they're overwhelmed, but I think about the bonus marchers in the 30s who had served in World War I. The soldiers who had been promised a bonus for their service and it didn't come. And finally, hundreds of thousands of them turned out in Washington, D.C. and more or less made the case, pay us our goddamn money or this country goes up in flames. Wonder what happened to that attitude.
It's about oil.
It's about oil.
It's about greed.
It's about greed.
It's about rich white men getting richer. It's about fear.
It's about fear.
And control.
And control.
Of those barrels of black gold.
Texas.
Yeah, step up, folks, to another war when we never really say what we're fighting for. It's easy to pretend we're defending our native soul.
What I think the president ought to do is he ought to get on the phone with the OPEC cartel and say, we expect you to open your spigots.
Yeah, how's that working, Chuckle Nuts? How's that working? Now, you know, I just feel compelled to answer the critics of my position now as fluid as it always has been. But my position on a Barack Obama presidency, which I see as another looming disaster, certainly not of the sort of George W. Bush, possibly worse for different reasons, hopefully not quite as bad. But the example that came out over the weekend, Barack Obama may ask Robert Gates, Bush's Secretary of Defense, to stay on in that position if he, Obama, becomes president. According to the Times Online of the UK, Obama's top foreign policy and national security advisors are pressing the case for keeping Robert Gates at the Pentagon after he won widespread praise for his performance. Praise from whom? What performance? I'm not clear on that. And then it says the move would be in keeping with Obama's desire to appoint a cabinet of all the talents. Richard Danzig, an advisor to Obama on national security and a former Navy secretary, said, quote, my personal position is Gates is a very good Secretary of Defense and would be an even better one in an Obama administration, end quote. And again, I don't know what that means either. Ivo de Alder of the Brookings Institute in Washington, a foreign policy advisor to Obama, said, quote, Robert Gates is one of the best defense secretaries we've had in a long time, and it makes a lot of sense to keep him, end quote. He doesn't offer a definition of the best or an example of why he considers this guy with the Brookings Institution, why he considers Gates to be one of the best defense secretaries we've had in a long time. Now, Gates is a former member of the bipartisan so-called Iraq Study Group. Remember that? He has been, according to those in the know, he's been quietly seeking an orderly transition to a new U.S. administration in January so that, according to people who know him, that hard-won military gains in Iraq are not thrown away in a hasty withdrawal. Hard-won military gains in Iraq. The only military gain that has occurred in Iraq, well, there's been two. The establishment of a puppet government that's not quite as puppet as the oil cartel, American, British, French oil cartel, hoped it would be. The very companies that were tossed out on their asses 32 years ago. And the second thing, the second hard-won military gain in Iraq is the fact that we are just about ready to take over the oil fields. What hard-won military gains is this guy talking about? Gates. What is he talking about? He doesn't want to see the hard-won military gains we have accomplished in Iraq be thrown away in a hasty withdrawal. What? Well, you know, I'm not trying to be cavalier here with you know, saying over and over again what, but I have no idea. I have no idea what these people are talking about. This is propaganda, purely and simply, just absolute propaganda. He's won widespread praise for his performance. What has he done? What has Gates done? There have been no new strategies or tactics that either have been announced or have presented themselves through results in Iraq. It's the same game. It just goes on and on, doesn't it? Gates recently said that Obama and McCain were likely to take, quote, a sensible approach, end quote, to Iraq because, quote, the next president would suffer the greatest consequences if we do get the end game wrong, end quote. If we get the end game wrong. And according to the Times Online, retaining Gates would give Obama cover for adjusting Obama's policies, if necessary, while assuring Republicans that withdrawing from Iraq would not imperil national security. Oh, let the Republicans know they're safe. Come on, Papa Barack. No more Papa Cheney or Daddy Bush. Come on, Barack, you got to step into the role. You're only 47, which is not necessarily young, but you got to step up. The Republicans are wetting their pants. Doo-doo is running down their pants legs and filling up their shoes. You have to put your arms around them, Barack, and tell them, it's okay, boys. Come here. Come to Papa. Come here, little Republicans. I know I'm not the same skin color as you, but come here. Where else you going to run to? Come here. So by keeping Gates, you see, Barack Obama makes the transition for these putrid-ass Republicans, these cowardly, war-loving little twits, easier. And God knows that's why we all work so hard for the Barack Obama campaign. Oh, Gates, by the way, has said he finds it, his word, inconceivable that he would stay on as Obama's Secretary of Defense. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Talk about distraction, about the way that we might go. Action, the headlines.
faster than a flying monkey, more powerful than a special prosecutor. It's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
More powerful than a special prosecutor? Well, that's wishful thinking. A couple of emails here from Abby regarding flatlining. Abby writes, here's some evidence to support your flatlining hypothesis. 2 weeks ago, we drove from the East Coast to Ohio and back. In 4 days, viewing the rear ends of thousands and thousands of cars, we saw only one political bumper sticker, and we're only 5 months from November. The one sticker looked exactly like the typical W with a flag, except when you got close up, you saw that it said, whoops. Jack writes, good evening, Mike. Regarding Americans have been tranquilized. Bush, Cheney, and the big oil companies are having their way with an America which was tranquilized by the initial phony war on terror slogan used by these cretins, allowing them to line their pockets from the blood of both innocent American and Iraqi people. Let us not forget that it was Cheney's secret energy meetings where the plans to divide the Iraqi oil fields were finally drawn up. Might I add, this was done prior to the invasion of Iraq. These sycophants knew exactly what they were doing, including the events of 9/11, the mother of all catalysts. Now these bastards have to protect their investment, i.e. the Iraqi oil fields, making certain Iran doesn't mingle with their profit margins. Hence, they must be dealt with accordingly. Jack. And then Barbara writes, Mike, I was once married to a man who would say the most awkward and embarrassing things. When asked about it, I learned to say something like, well, he has his own opinions. He's entitled to them. He doesn't speak for me. Why can't the candidates on either side just say something like that? Barack Obama is not responsible for the opinions, sound or not, of General Wesley Clark or anyone else, nor should he be held to account for them. The general is an adult and is certainly entitled to believe that McCain's military service did or did not provide certain qualifications. Obama did not say that. Another adult did. He can certainly say he does not agree, but why let the right-wing nut jobs get traction from his comments? Oh, well, I agree with you that the country seems to be asleep. Otherwise, why were not the news outlets playing a continuous loop of the comment by David Addington that he would not provide legal advice to the Judiciary Committee about whether or not it was okay to torture a suspect's child in front of the suspect to get information? Barbara. What she's referring to, of course, regarding General Wesley Clark, are the comments on Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer's program, excuse me, on CBS yesterday. Joe Lieberman was on that program. We'll get to that in a second. McCain's readiness to be president was disputed by General Wesley Clark, retired. He is, of course, is backing Barack Obama for president. But Clark said something that we've been saying on this program for, I don't know what, 2 years? Or has it been six and a half? I don't know. Maybe way back when McCain was running against Bush in 2000. I don't know. It all kind of bleeds together. I'm sure it was more recent than that. But we've been saying that McCain is no more of a war hero than I'm the Pope. What constitutes a war hero? Bombing and strafing civilians from 30,000 feet or 10,000 feet and then getting shot down and tortured for 5 years and then released does not make you a hero. It makes you a survivor. It does not make you a hero. And who labels this man a hero? These right-wing nut jobs, the Republicans who wet their pants every time they hear a firecracker go off. The ones who would no more commit their sons and daughters or themselves back in the day to a combat operation than fly to the moon. So they label someone like John McCain, who flew a few combat missions when he was a squadron leader. It was not a squadron leader in the Vietnam conflict, or the Vietnam invasion, or the Vietnam occupation. He was not a combat squadron leader. And when he was shot down, he was in the process of committing more murder and mayhem of innocent people, civilians. The Vietnam version of shock and awe. Kill enough of the sons of bitches and they'll surrender. They didn't. So Clark says, quote, well, I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president or a definition of a hero. I added the definition of a hero. Clark said, I think Joe Lieberman has it exactly backwards here. I think being president is about having good judgment. It's about the ability to communicate, my friends. And what Barack Obama brings is incredible communication skills, proven judgment. You look at his meteoric rise in politics and you see a guy who deals with people well, who understands issues, who brings people together, and who has good judgment in moving forward. That sounds like somebody you would like to have run General Electric or Ford Motor Company or, I don't know. Harvard University. Yeah, I know. I'm talking about Barack Obama. All these qualifications. What does it take to be a president in these times? It takes someone who will... Now, I'm talking about real politic here. It takes someone who will present a grand, independent, change-oriented face to the public and in the background will do exactly what corporate America tells him to do or her to do. Because to do otherwise will be to cause all sorts of chaos and ugly things to happen and stuff to start flying apart and falling down and huge pools of liquid collecting around. You know what I mean? Now, to be a real leader of the United States involves telling the corporations, all right, here's the new game. If you want to leave, leave. And we will dedicate billions of dollars to forming new corporations. We did it once. We can do it again. Here are the rules. And then lay out the rules. Labor rules, environmental rules, wage rules, profit rules, how the system works. That's what a leader does. Barack Obama, as far as I can detect, is not a leader. He will make a good president, but he won't make a good leader. There is a difference. There didn't used to be. Wesley Clark went on and said, because in the matters of national security policymaking, it's a matter of understanding risk. Well, yeah, but so is capital investment. But I digress. It's a matter of gauging your opponents, and it's a matter of being held accountable. John McCain's never done any of that in his official positions. I certainly honor his service, but he hasn't held executive responsibility, end quote. Now, that is what has gotten most of us couldn't care less. This is what's gotten the chattering class's dander up. So immediately, John McCain says, well, my friends, General Wesley Clark, my friends, who outranks me in every single conceivable way, has a right to his opinion. I have other people who would say, no, I'm not like that. I'm a good hero and a good leader. But one thing I do believe is that Barack Obama should condemn these comments immediately. So what does Barack Obama do? He condemns the comments immediately. And that's what Barbara is referring to. Is it Barbara? Yeah, Barbara. Why can't Barack Obama just say, Wesley Clark said what? Did he? Really? Well, that's interesting. Next question. What did Barack Obama... I don't think we should... I honor McCain's... You honor a killer, a murderer, someone who bombed civilian populations and shot them and destroyed aircraft on the decks of aircraft carriers and who whined and weaseled and wheedled and as a prisoner of war? You honor that, Senator Obama? Do you really? Okay, well, yeah. You'll make a good U.S. president. But you'll never be a leader. Never. And you know it, and your advisors know it, and corporate America knows it, and celebrates that fact. So, Lieberman was on the same program. He says, in describing the reasons he believes the Republicans nominee for president would be better served than the Democrats is because history shows the United States will likely face a terrorist attack in 2009. History shows that in 2009, which is not history, that we're going to have a terrorist attack. Lieberman, this little rat, oh God, what a, never mind. Lieberman said, quote, our enemies will test the new president early. Remember that the truck bombing World Trade Center happened in the first year of the Clinton administration, and 9/11 happened in the first year of the Bush administration, and my wife Hadassah got all weird on me in the first year of our marriage. So, you know, enemies test you early. By the way, here's the point. We're in a war against Islamist extremists who attacked us on 9/11, and you know, they've been trying to attack us in many, many ways since then, and I know what I'm talking about because I live with Hadassah, okay? Ten before the hour. Oh, my God. Kathy in Green Bay writes, Obama can't say Clark doesn't speak for him because Clark's one of the people that Obama has out speaking for him. I personally, Kathy writes, thought Clark was quite candid and appropriate. Yeah, so do I. That's why I preface it. I hate to say it. Well, I've been saying that for 2 years. But in a case of John McCain, I have to say it. I have to say it. I don't know if Wesley Clark has said anything about this before, but McCain is not a war hero. What the hell kind? You know, Audie Murphy was a war hero. Smedley Butler was a war hero. You can name war heroes. There are heroes in combat. John McCain happens not to have been one. He was a killer of people who he thought couldn't fight back with what? Anti-aircraft guns? And William in Hollywood writes, Mike, do you recall the, he writes, I'm beginning to feel like the couple in the Twilight Zone episode. Do you recall the one where this couple were in this town and everything they touched was found to be fake? In the end, they realized they were in fact captured and living in a child's game world where even the train that bordered the town went in circles. They were on another planet. You're right. Yeah. And Operation Horse's Head. You know, we started the program pretty much by telling you about Maliki's cousin or whatever being butchered by U.S. Forces. Chris Floyd writes, as we know from The Godfather, that seminal work of American political philosophy, which serves as the Bible for the Bush administration, a horse's head in the bed can be a highly effective tool in difficult contract negotiations. Last Friday, Bush went his fictional mentors one better in these negotiations over an agreement setting out the public terms of a de facto permanent American occupation of the conquered land. He laid the corpse of a kinsman on the doorstep of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. McClatchy Newspapers reports that U.S. Special Forces launched a deadly raid in al-Maliki's home province, which had supposedly been returned to the full control of the Iraqi government. Without any warning to Iraqi forces, the American units stormed the rural town of Janaja at dawn on Friday with 60 troops, and in the course of the raid, killed Ali Abdul Hassan Rajak al-Maliki, one of the prime minister's many relatives in the area where he was born and where his tribe is based. No Iraqi authority was notified of this heavily armed raid, complete with jets and helicopters, on supposedly Iraqi-controlled territory. Certainly, the prime minister himself knew nothing of the impending attack on his hometown. And once the operation was over, Iraqi military officers trained, funded, armed, and embedded with U.S. forces said that
the Americans had acted on faulty intelligence. God damn, really? Again? Whew!
The raid comes at what appears to be a delicate juncture in the ongoing talks to establish a status of forces agreement for the American military presence in Iraq. Iraqi government officials have publicly balked at some of the most howlingly sinister, mustache-twirling proposals of the Bush administration. For example, 50 American bases, complete legal immunity from Iraqi law, right to launch deadly attacks anytime, anywhere in the country, right to launch attacks on other nations from Iraq, total control of Iraqi airspace, and so on. The Bush administration has made a show of recalibrating some of its demands, and in the end will probably modify a few of them, 30 permanent bases, say, instead of 50. Or has already been suggested putting Iraqi guard posts outside the gargantuan U.S. military plantations and pretending they're actually Iraqi bases with a few invited guests inside. And he goes on. So not only did the murder of Maliki's kinsman have to do with the fact that the oil minister said, open bidding, open bidding, open bidding. No, not the four Cheney-designated oil companies that we threw out of our country 32 years ago. No, no, open bidding, open bidding. Whoom. That was quick. Maliki's kinsman is dead. Not only that, but also the fact that al-Maliki is dragging his heels, so to speak, and hanging out way too much with Ahmadinejad over in Iran. I mean, this crap's got to stop. Here's your dead cousin. Cousin? Now listen up. Cheney had this meeting years ago. You silly son of a bitch, before we ever came over there and deposed your leader. No more of this. Next time, it's your old lady. You know what I'm saying? Huh? Boom! While she's out shopping for pomegranates or whatever you people eat over there. I don't know. Oh, that's Afghanistan. Never mind. So Operation Horse's Head. We won't know for a few days whether or not it was a success. It was a success insofar as the military objective was accomplished, and that was the death of Maliki's cousin. But as far as convincing Maliki to stop this open bidding nonsense, what is that? You know, stop that. And get real about status of forces agreement, or as I like to refer to it in military jargon, the SOFA. When we leave our imperial forces in Iraq, they're going to be just that, imperial forces. We, the Obama crime family, will make the decisions as to how those forces operate. Period. We'll be back after the break. And your phone calls. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. One last thing before we go to your calls. About the section of the FISA Spy on Americans, Kill the Fourth Amendment bill passed by Democrats. The section that supports telecom immunity. Politico.com points out that House Democrats who flipped their votes to support retroactive immunity for those telecom companies that violated the law, those Democrats took thousands of dollars more from phone companies than Democrats who consistently voted against legislation with an immunity provision. That's according to an analysis by MapLight.org. MapLight.org. The 94 Democrats who changed their positions received, on average, $8,359 in contributions from Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint, according to the analysis by MapLight, a nonpartisan organization that tracks the connection between campaign contributions and legislative outcomes. The retroactive immunity, of course, is going to squash 40 lawsuits pending against these companies. The 116 Democrats who remained opposed to this immunity received about half that from the telecoms during the three-year period we're talking about here. That's according to the analysis by MapLight.org. David Newman, who is the executive director of MapLight, said, regardless which way the legislators vote, the fact is most of them get money from the telecom industry, and that buys access even if it doesn't buy a favorable result for the telecom company. They all get it. They all get it. The only answer to that, of course, is to prevent even 2 cents coming from a corporation, whether it's bundled or however, you know, just absolutely under penalty of time in jail to get the corporate money. But that'll never happen because the corporations own every single member of Congress, all of them, with the possible exception. I don't know, Dennis Kucinich, I'd have to take a look at his contributions and how he votes and so on and so forth. There may be a couple of members of the Senate, a couple more members of the House. But generally speaking, making a sweeping generalization, all of them are owned, all members of the House and Senate are owned by these filthy corporations. And to you right-wingers who send me emails to say, well, without the filthy corporations, Mike, how would there be jobs in America? Oh, kiss my grits, please. The corporations have exported the jobs. What's left? Huh? You jerks.
The corporations provide the jobs.
Yeah, to Chinese workers and Indians and Vietnamese. Yeah, okay. Now, regarding the telecom stuff, one of the whistleblowers from AT&T, Mark Klein, retired AT&T engineer, who stepped forward with the technical documents at the heart of this anti-wiretapping case against AT&T, is really upset at the Senate's vote last Wednesday night. To a vote that, in fact, puts an end to the lawsuit, his lawsuit, more than 30 others. He says the Democratic leadership is touting the deal as a compromise, but in fact, they have endorsed the infamous Nuremberg defense.
I'm just following orders.
The judge can only check their paperwork. And the cynical deal is a Democratic exercise in deceit and cowardice. Klein saw a network monitoring room built in AT&T's Internet Switching Center that only National Security Administration-approved techies had access to. Do you understand that? A network monitoring room being built in AT&T's Internet Switching Center that was available only to NSA technicians. So Mark Klein squirreled away documents and then presented them to the press and the Electronic Frontier Foundation after news of the government's warrantless wiretapping program broke. Wired.com independently acquired a copy of the documents, and they have them. and published the wiring documents in May 2006 so they could be evaluated. You can still see them. Go to wired.com. The lawsuit that resulted from Klein's documents is now waiting on the Ninth U.S. Appeals Court to rule whether it can proceed, despite the government saying the whole matter is a state secret. Now, this more or less renders almost moot, or it was rendered moot, by the action by the Democratic-controlled House and Senate to grant immunity, retroactive immunity. A lower court had ruled that the lawsuit could proceed because the government admitted the program existed and that the courts could handle evidence safely and in secret. So go ahead. That was their public face. Their private face, the horse's head option. Just like they killed Maliki's cousin, they warned the Democrats, oh no. Klein says, Congress has made the FISA law a dead letter. Such a law is useless if the president can break it with impunity, which he can. Thus, the Democrats have surreptitiously repudiated the main reform of the post-Watergate era and adopted Nixon's line, which is, quote, when the president does it, that means it is not illegal, end quote. Klein continues, this is the judicial logic of a dictatorship. The surveillance system now approved by Congress provides the physical apparatus for the government to collect and store a huge database on virtually the entire population, available for data mining whenever the government wants to target its political opponents at any given moment, all in the hands of an unrestrained executive power. It is the infrastructure for a police state. It is the infrastructure for a police state. Now, obviously, when Barack Obama is president and there is a veto-proof majority of Democrats in the House and the Senate, one of the first actions of the Obama presidency and the veto-proof majorities in the House and the Senate, Democrats, will be to pass a law that negates FISA and puts it back to what it was as a result of the Church Committee hearings back in the 70s. Now, you know that's going to happen, right? Huh? President Obama is going to do that. The Democratic-controlled House and Senate are going to provide him a bill he can sign that completely negates everything this Democratic House and Senate has done. Right? And the reason they're going to do that is because the Democratic President Barack Obama will get the leaders of the new democratically controlled House and Senate, the veto-proof majority, into the Oval Office for a sit-down. And the sit-down will essentially say, all right, boys, when I was on the campaign trail, I said I would review everything that George Bush has done. And the most egregious violations of the law, we will correct. Therefore, let's start with repairing the Bill of Rights. Get rid of this. Send me a bill. Right? Isn't that what he said? Huh? Should that be done on the first week after his inauguration or the first 2 weeks? I guess we'll have to wait and see. Right? Right. Your phone calls when we come back. I'm Mike Beloy. This is Nova M Radio.
When all our rights have been taken away, would you have guessed that a little collie weed could ever bring all of these vultures little feet? What it feels like we're living in a police state. You broke the law, so accept your fate. They pull your car over and they beat you too.
The Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
Yeah, it does. 21 past the hour. You want to do some phone calls? Let's do that. The number here is 800-989-1480. We'll start with Vic, who is in Cedar Creek, Texas, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Vic.
Good evening, Mike.
Hey.
Well, you opened up the door when you used the two words Israel and corporations early.
Yeah.
And I hear over and over again people asking talk show hosts, why Israel? You know, I guess most people's impression of Israel is a bunch of country of 7 million people walking around just hiding under their desks or something. When in fact, you know, Israel and American corporations are synonymous. I believe that Israel is essentially the 51st state. You know, it's likely that the Pentium microprocessor that Intel developed in Israel, and most everybody's computer was made in Israel. Windows, XP, NT was developed in Israel. Motorola is in Israel. Cisco's in Israel.
Well, I'll have to take your word for that, Vic, because I don't know where these microchips. When you say developed, do you mean manufactured or actually invented and developed?
Invented, developed, and made. They said the Pentium 4 microprocessor and the Centrino processor were entirely designed, developed, and produced in Israel. So if there's a fear that Iran might attack Israel, it's not because Israel is the home of the invisible man in the sky, like you call him. It's the fact that American corporations are, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, Israel's got 100. It's the 100th smallest.
All right, wait a minute, Vic. I'm getting lost.
I know, because I have so much information.
All right, no wait. You said let's go ahead and stipulate. Although I'll take your word for it. Let's stipulate that all this the chip part of computers is made in Israel.
Correct.
So what?
Well, if Intel's microprocessing ability mm-hmm. went away tomorrow, we're talking about billions of dollars that can be, you know, these are small things that we shipped out on $1 billion.
Wait, how's it going to go away?
Well, they're worried about Iran.
All right, I'm sorry to sound so dense. Do you mean if Iran attacks Israel?
Sure. Can you see the implications? It's not just that a poor, oppressed people might be turned into a ball of grass. Is that Intel's chip and Microsoft and Cisco and AOL, their pool of highly skilled people.
All right. Well, let me ask you this: Is Israel the only place these microchips are being manufactured?
90% of them are being manufactured in Israel. They have $100 billion economy, Mike. They also have 250 F-16s. They have the fourth largest.
Okay. All right. Right. No. I understand. They also have the third largest fourth or fifth largest nuclear arsenal on Earth. But
correct.
No. I'm trying to get the connection here because I hate to sound stupid, but I had no idea that the computing technology was developed or is developed and is manufactured in Israel. I still don't understand though. If Iran were to, I mean, if the threat from Iran is to wipe out the computer chip industry, why? I mean, are you the only one that knows this, or is this common knowledge? I haven't heard of this.
Well, it's easy to find the information. Israel also had 3,000 high tech startup companies. They're ranked number two. On NASDAQ, Israel has the largest number of NASDAQ-listed companies outside of the United States and Canada. I didn't make this up.
Well, wait. Yeah, but what you're telling me, I almost want to say, well, good for them.
Well, yeah, they have 7,000 people. They have more university degrees than any other.
Okay, well, then I misunderstood. You're praising Israel, not criticizing it.
Well, I'm merely giving you a reason why we support Israel. And there is a sinister part of this.
Well, I would disagree with you, Vic. I don't think that we're supporting Israel from the standpoint of saving the computer chip industry. You know, I've said many times on this program that we have this unequivocal, unquestioned support of Israel starting first from guilt that we did nothing when 6 million went into the ovens. Secondly, for the past 55 or 50 years, immediately following World War II, Israel was in fact the only strategic ally, not necessarily a real ally, but the only strategic ally we had in the Middle East. And third, for the most part, they look like us. So, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, so far, if you're saying there's a fourth reason in the computer chip industry, okay, I'll accept that. But I think it's great if a society can, what did you say, 2,000, 3,000 startup businesses. That's kind of cool when you think about it. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
Twenty-six before the hour. All right, I've got a lot of emails on this, of what Vic brought up about Israeli businesses and Intel or computer chips. Kathy says, when I Googled where are Intel chips manufactured, Intel chips, world's largest corporation. Really? Intel Corporation, the world's largest corporation? I didn't know that. Has been operating in the Philippines for almost 30 years, calling itself the first multinational company that established a branch in the country. Intel manufactures processors and chips in its Philippine plant, which is expected to be Intel's biggest assembly and testing operation worldwide soon. Other foreign electronic IT firms are Texas Instruments, blah, blah, blah. Let me see what else. No, I'm not going to read that one on the air. This is from Randy. Gee, Mike, South Korea is a huge player in the computer chip industry. They've even had World Trade Organization battles with Intel over copyrights, etc. I don't think that's why we continue to blindly support Israel. I don't either. What else we got here? Okay, Reggie. Intel Corporation, world's largest semiconductor company and the inventor of the x86 series of microprocessors. The processors found in most personal computers. Founded on July 18, 1968 as Integrated Electronics Corporation and based in Santa Clara, California, USA, Intel also makes motherboard chipsets, network cards and ICs, flash memory, graphic chips, embedded processors and other devices related to communications and computing. Founded by semiconductor pioneers Robert Noyce and Gordon Moore, and widely associated with the executive leadership and vision of Andrew Grove, Intel combines advanced chip design capability. Okay, on and on and on. All right. I don't know, Vic. I've got about 15 emailers here who are filling me up with information about where microchips and Intel processors and so on and so forth. Not to say that... certainly not to say that Israel doesn't, you know, contribute with their research and development. I'm sure they do. Israel is a small country. It would be rather difficult to have great big massive heavy industry plants operating in Israel, right? But, Vic, it seems like a lot of people have found information by just doing some quick Googling and research that would not challenge what you said, but broaden it a bit. You know, I don't think, from what I've just read here in the past 2 minutes, that Israel has a monopoly on computer processors or computer chip development. Okay? No offense. I mean, I'm not going to argue with your sources either, but it appears that it's a little bit broader than you were stating. All right, back to your phone calls. Len is calling from New York, listening on the Internet. Len, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
I just remembered that I'm coming for you mm-hmm. that you were doing for a while there.
I'm coming for you.
No, Intel is just one of very many, many high-tech companies there that they do design. What scared me when tonight made me want to call is when I heard you say for the first time, at least, that I heard it, calling it the Obama crime family.
Well, I'm just kidding.
Well, no, I got you.
But
you're looking at his utmost potential there.
Right. I'm not suggesting that it's a crime family yet, but you're right. It certainly has the potential, as would any, as far as I'm concerned, any administration in this country have the potential of going bogus.
It's scary. And, apart from everything else, I think I heard recently that the whole telecom thing is still up in the air in terms of whether there is criminal liability exemption in this bill. But that's not really what I was focusing on. But when you mentioned that it was 8,500, the ones that voted with the telecom companies, if you think about how little 8,500 is, I don't think it could buy me 2 minutes on your show.
No, I understand. I don't know why 8,000 or 9,000, I think it would average out to be $9,000 over a 2-year period for the company or for the legislators who voted, flipped their vote. And half of that, roughly 4,000 or 5,000, for the Democrats who did not flip their vote. And that was my first thought. They can get them that cheap now, but apparently, so.
I think that's what I paid, to cancel my contract on my cell phone earlier. But two scary things that I heard today, and Michael Scheuer was on one program, and Jim Webb was on the other. Michael Scheuer was answering what we do about the erupting problem with Al-Qaeda, the re-erupting problem with Al-Qaeda. And he was saying, well, one of the first things the next president has to do is explain to people that we're going to need conscription. And simultaneously, of course, Jim Webb was on the other on the other channel talking about the Pride and the new GI benefits. And, those two seem to suddenly go hand in hand. I mean, it gives somebody at least a reason for going to war that they can get their education paid for down the road.
You're not suggesting that this kind of stuff is coordinated, are you?
I am not. And at the same time, it just came up. Well, 5 years ago when my daughter was 9, I told her by the time she's 18, there will either be a draft for everyone or she'll be in college learning that this was the worst, administration in this country's history.
Right.
And, where we are still is a question. But really what I also wanted to let you know from, people that I heard from this weekend, a person, an Israeli journalist, the question is still who's going to bomb Iran?
Right.
Whether it's going to be Israel or it's going to be America.
Right.
Now, on the one hand, we have Dick Cheney, and by virtue of having Dick Cheney, we have George Bush, who want to do it simply because, they've got the fun, the fun bombs to do it with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like their plaything, the idea of doing it. And on the other side of the ocean is Israel, who is only looking at the potential of doing this because they seriously consider, just like they did, oh, by the way, in the process I heard that thing that they blew up in Syria was actually funded by Iran.
Really?
So they actually consider it just too serious a threat. They really don't know who might get their hands on this stuff and how stupid they might be. And given how small a country it is, you know, they definitely don't feel that they could take a chance. Mm-hmm. And somewhere between the next in the next 6 to 18 months, they would expect to be doing it, you know, to be bombing whatever facilities they could identify as producing nuclear materials. So
no,
you know,
but the reality, the on the ground reality, my understanding anyway, of Iran's nuclear program, whatever it is, they may be on the verge of a neutron bomb death ray that they can bounce off the moon. But regardless of how far they are along in terms of developing nuclear weapons or developing nuclear energy-producing technology, regardless of all that, the facilities in which all this stuff is going on are scattered throughout the entire country. This is not like going after, was it Osirik? What was the Iraqi nuclear plant that the Israelis got in?
Yeah, Osirik or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, that's why last week they had, they couldn't even hide it. They had a test run on, I mean, they've been, I learned quite a bit. I mean, it was a long talk that this guy gave, you know. This was their number one concern going back to about 1992 or 1993, that they knew Iran at some point was going to be an extremely serious threat to them. And, you know, the tipping point was when they held that conference, Holocaust Deniers Conference.
Wait, Len, pause
sure.
for just a second here, because first of all, do you believe that the Iranians are suicidal? You know, we lived on this planet for the better part of half a century with the Soviets. At one point, I believe they had upwards of 45,000 nuclear warheads targeted on the United States. We had an equivalent amount, at least in terms of megatonnage, targeted against them. And nothing happened, even though we fought our surrogate wars, our proxy wars. Is it the belief of the people of Israel that Iran wants to commit suicide? Because as soon as a rocket goes up, Israel would launch a no-holds-barred, massive nuclear retaliation. And Iran, I'll give you a second to think about the answer. Let me put you on hold. Iran would then become only kind of a note in Persian, a footnote in Persian history. Maybe you can give me an answer for that when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
I want to live in a country that's safe, in a land that's clean and free, for every color and culture, every person, every belief. Your greed, your fear, and your lies ain't gonna push me around. I'm gonna use the power I have. I'm gonna vote you right out of that house.
Ten before the hour, before we go back to Len, thanks to Ian Huff, Billy Foster, Ben Birch, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Sharon Gordy, and Catherine Bay, all part of the paid and unpaid crew that produces this program on some level. Thanks to everybody. All right, back to Len now. The question was, are Iranians suicidal?
Well, you know, that's the problem that Israel... Remember that Israel's size makes it feel like it's in a corner to begin with. And then the next question becomes, are Iranians suicidal? The question, are Iranians able to secure their arsenal from somebody who isn't insane? And that's the ultimate question to which they can't afford. The Israeli government will probably never be able to feel, you know, that they can afford to answer that question well, they don't know.
Well, again, taking a look at recent history, I'm old enough to remember the conversation that I believe passed between Kennedy and Khrushchev. And I think it was in that conversation when Khrushchev said, "We will bury you." Now, the implications of that at the time in the unsophisticated United States of the early 60s or late 50s, the implications of that were anything you wanted it to be. Bury usually is what you do to something you've killed or something that's dead. So when Ahmadinejad says we will, even though this is not what he said, according to what I've read as a Farsi word-for-word translation, but the conventional wisdom is he said we will wipe Israel off the map. Is that any different from we will bury you and we have 45,000 nuclear-tipped warheads with which we can do it? My point is madmen, look at Richard Nixon, madmen have always had access to vast arsenal of nuclear weapons. Remember, it was Kissinger who notified the Joint Chiefs, any order that came from Nixon there towards the end that had the word launch in it was to immediately be forwarded to him, Kissinger, because there was going to be no launch. So even though there are madmen in positions of power around the earth, does that necessarily follow that they are going to use these weapons if it means mutual assured destruction?
You're 100% right. At the same time, all I can say is when it comes to the element of jihadist, theology, the fear is that you just simply, have too much opportunity to lose, to find someone who just thinks it's the greater good. And Saddam Hussein, who is a secularist, nonetheless spent his time saying that, all of this arsenal he was building was, for Israel. I mean, if you were going to invite this trouble, this is how you would do it. And, my only point to this guy had to hightail it after his speech. I didn't have a chance to talk to him long enough. My only point to him was, well, under these circumstances, you damn well better hope that Obama is going to win, because at least he intends to talk. That's what he's saying. He intends to talk. And, I don't think under an Obama administration, he would be the one to launch anything against Iran. But, it's just a problem of, considering people have language, they're looking at Iran and how are they choosing to use their language and their money. They're funding Hezbollah, they're funding Hamas, they're doing everything they can to create, to invite disaster. In fact, one of the conversations that we had beforehand was, are the Palestinians, waiting? The Palestinian leader in the West Bank was asking the Israelis, when are you going to take care of Hamas? Understanding that, there needs to be in the Palestinian, psyche an understanding that their leaders are bringing them towards destruction, as opposed to trying to make their lives better. And I called it a German moment, where you realize your leaders have brought you towards destruction.
Well, so, Len, we're out of time. I wish we had more time to talk about this now. But
I'll give you a call another night.
Yeah, I appreciate your insights into this. For those of you who don't know, Len is an Orthodox Jew who lives in New York, who has access to conversations that the average among us who are too busy doing other things don't have access to, and I always appreciate what he has to say, whether I agree on a philosophical basis with what he has to say or not. So, just for clarification, so you know that Lynn presents a decidedly specific point of view. And I can appreciate hearing that point of view without getting into what perhaps some of my emailers might see as, well, Malloy, why didn't you challenge him on that? I just, I kind of want to hear what the man has to say. like Barack Obama wants to hear what the Iranians have to say. Maybe it's kind of like that, right? Are we out of time? Pretty much. Anyway, thanks a lot for participating tonight. I do appreciate it. Did we cover everything tonight? For the first time in a long time, I think we just about covered everything that I had wanted to bring to the fore. So that's a first. I usually have about 15 or 16. You know, it's hard to stop. It's like doing bad drugs. You're going through, skimming through the internet on a given day. Like, you know, what will make good subject material for the program? I usually wind up with 20 or 30 topics, and then they just sit on the pile and never go anywhere. So I'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.